The world of finance is about to change forever. And it starts with your computer. I'm talking about bitcoins. Bitcoins and cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, and there are other cryptocurrencies that are emerging. And tonight I will be talking about bitcoins in particular. And then we'll get a little understanding. How many people here have heard of bitcoins? Just about everybody. How many people here are using bitcoins? We're going to change that tonight. Before we can talk about bitcoins, we need to know, in finance, we need to understand a few things about finance and currencies. So I want to talk about currency. Originally, we had representative currency. This was the silver certificates and the gold certificates, bills that would have written on it, $1 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. That means that your money, all the paper currency, was represented by an equal amount of silver or gold at Fort Knox. And you can go to the bank with that bill, with a silver certificate or a gold certificate, and they will give you that dollar amount in gold or silver. So every dollar was accounted for, because that's what really has value, was the precious metals. There is scarcity, so the supply and demand, that's what had value, but it's very cumbersome to go around carrying bags of silver and gold to make your daily purchases. So we represent it in bills. Then come along 1971, the Nixon shock, when President Nixon took us off of the gold standard to, as he quotes, to lay to rest the bugaboo of what is called devaluation. And now we have what we call fiat currency. Fiat currency is any money that is declared by a central government to be legal tender. It is not backed by any gold. It is not backed by silver. It is not backed by anything at all except your faith. Your faith in the government, and your faith in the fact that you can go to a store with that money and that somebody will accept it as payment towards goods and services. That is the only thing that backs up the fiat currency. There's one other type of currency which is not really currency. It's called scrip. Scrip is a type of currency, it represents currency, but it is not legal tender. An example might be in the military, if we're at war, and they couldn't get actual cash to the soldiers, they would issue scrip, which would have an equivalent value, and it would be accepted at the barracks, and eventually traded for legal tender when it became available. Coupons, gift cards are a great example. You buy a $25 gift card from Macy's. It's worth $25, but you can only use it at Macy's. At some points, cities, like in this case, the city of Long Branch, created their own currency, their own scrip, that could be used in the city to help stimulate the local economy. I bring up scrip because that will find a commonality in some of the alternate currencies that we'll talk about. So with bitcoins, there's no central government control. It's a peer-to-peer network, and it's all open source. All the code is open source. There's nothing can be hidden because anybody who's running the software can see what is in the software. I have a question. Yes. Well, it will have an equivalence in bitcoins in the fact that bitcoins don't have anything to back it up or any value. It's just money that can be printed. The government can print as much as they want of it. They can print off all more bills, and the more that is printed, it doesn't mean anything other than your faith that you can accept it. And the value of it goes down the more that's printed. So if they go and print out another $1 million, that's $1 million more in, well, not that that's much in the U.S. economy, if they printed $1 billion more, that's going to flood the currency and make it worth even less. And again, with the faith, if somebody were to take an exact duplicate of a perfect copy of a $100 bill, and would make 1 billion of them and fly over every major city of the United States and drop them out of the airplanes, everybody would be running out to the street to grab this money, $100 bills or $20 bills, stuff their pockets, stuff bags with it. But then if you go to a store to buy something, what is it worth? You go to buy something for $20, and they're going to say, well, what do I need your $20 for? I have all these $20. That's going to cost you $5,000. The money becomes worth less because there is an increased supply. Another good thing about bitcoins is that there is a limited supply. 21 million bitcoins will ever be created. Never another one after that. I would love to tell you who invented bitcoins, but nobody knows. There's an anonymous person named Satoshi Nakamoto. It's a pseudonym. It could be one person. It could be a group of people. Nobody actually knows who created Bitcoins. Now, here's an interesting story. Bitcoin started in 2010. And in early 2010, it was very easy to mine Bitcoins. And I will get into what mining is, what that means to mine the Bitcoins. But it was very easy to mine them on a simple laptop computer. Your CPU could process the mathematical transactions that were necessary to mine the Bitcoins. So they were very easy, and there were not that many people doing it. So there was a limited supply, but there was no demand. So they weren't worth anything. So on May 21st, 2010, Laszlo Hayes in Florida, he went on a message board and, just for a proof of concept, posted a message saying, I will give somebody 10,000 Bitcoins if you send me a pizza. Now, at the time, the Bitcoins had a value of about 0.04, 0.4 of a cent per Bitcoin. Somebody even replied to his message saying, you know, you could trade that for $40. But he got his wish, and he got his pizza. Two pizzas from Papa John's. And he was ecstatic about this. Here he is, he got two pizzas delivered to his house. And all he had to do for it was compute some numbers on a computer. That's amazing. Fast forward to 2012, which is when I got interested in Bitcoins, when I discovered them, and I had to go and buy Bitcoins. At this point, they were worth $12 per Bitcoin. Now that's a $120,000 pizza. Papa John's. Now, at that time, there was a little bit more, there was more attention to Bitcoin, there was a little bit more demand, so they had a lot more value. There were a few websites that were accepting Bitcoin, but not that many. It was more of a concept, but it was looking like a more prosperous concept, something that is going to happen. And at the time, it was very difficult to get Bitcoins. In order to get I bought two Bitcoins. It cost me $24, and I had to go to CVS to send a Western Union MoneyGram to somebody who was then going to, once he received it and confirmed it 2 days later, he sent me two Bitcoins over the network. And in my Bitcoin wallet, I had two Bitcoins. But it took a couple of days to do that. Today, it's a lot easier. And as more and more acceptance came about, and the financial crisis in Cyprus, and a lot of people were taking their money because their own currency was becoming worthless, were buying it into Bitcoins, and the prices skyrocketed. At one point last year, it hit over $1,000. It hit a high of $1,200. And that means we have here $12 million pizza. I'm glad he's got some toppings on that. It's only Papa John's. If I want a $12 million pizza, I want somebody to fly to New York, pick up the dough, install a brick oven on the airplane, cook it on the way so that it's fresh, piping hot when he takes off the plane to give me a fresh New York pizza. That's what I want for $12 million. So Bitcoins are now, when I wrote this slide, Bitcoins were trading about $800, which makes the pizza index $8 million. Actually, there's a few things going on, and it's very volatile, and today it was trading at about $650. So the pizza index is about $6,500,000. So that's how Bitcoins became about and how the value started. As you can see, the supply and the demand. The more demand there is, the more it's worth, because the supply will always be limited. So to understand it, yes. Well, I'm going to go into that when I talk about this, but the person who made the protocol was that anonymous person, Satoshi Nakamoto. So I will get into the protocol, and which will explain how that number came about. But before I can even understand Bitcoins, let's take we'll take a little experiment here, a thought experiment, and we're going to create a new coin tonight. We're going to create a coin, and we'll call it Funcoin. Now, let's say I have Funcoins. I want to send Bob one Funcoin. So I go and send him, I have a wallet on my computer, he has the software on his computer, there's all these computers that we've set up with the Funcoin wallet, and I go and send him a Funcoin. Now what's to stop me from copying that Funcoin and sending it to Charlie and Denise, the same coin? So we need to make need some more protocols in there. So what we do is we have a letter of intent, and we attach this. We'll add this to the protocol. So now, when I send that coin, the data that I will be sending is a letter of intent that says, I am Jonathan, and I am sending one fun coin to Bob. And I will sign that with my private key. This is where the encryption comes in. There's a private key, and a public key. The private key is something that you have on your computer. Only you have that. Nobody else knows your private key, but the whole world will know your public key. And it's the combination of the public key and the private key. You take that public key, will confirm that the private key that you signed with is in fact you. It confirms the identity of the signer. So you don't have to know the private key, but the public key will confirm the identity of the signer, confirming that it is an authentic private key. So now that we have this, the letter of intent, we know where the coin is coming from and who it's going to. So I'm sending out one fun coin to Bob. Now, what's to stop me from sending the same message over and over and over, copying that message? So Bob gets a fun coin. Now he gets another fun coin. And now he gets another fun coin. Did he get 10 fun coins? Or did he get? Did I just send the same one 10 times? So we need to do something else to make sure that that doesn't happen. So we give it a serial number. Now the message is, I am Jonathan, and I am sending one fun coin with a serial number 10ABCDE to Bob, again, signed with the public, with my private key, and they can see it with the public key. Now, if I'm sending a duplicate coin, the entire network will know, because it's going to be broadcast to the entire network of Bitcoin, of Funcoin. And if you need to track the serial numbers, you track it in the bank. So who's the bank? And where are the serial numbers stored? And how do we verify them? Everybody is the bank. There's some, all the transactions and all the Bitcoins, Funcoins, all the serial numbers will be stored in what we call a blockchain, which is a long string of data that just keeps growing and growing, that contains every single transaction and every serial number for every coin. And it is distributed to all the nodes on the network. So when I send that coin out, they can verify it. The person who receives the coin can verify it. They look at their copy of the blockchain and say, yes, he does own this coin with this serial number, and I will accept that. And he sends it out to others on the networks, and they can say, yes, that is correct. We concur. He does own that coin, and he is sending it to you. So this is what the blockchain might look like. It's just a whole series of numbers, of serial numbers and transactions. So now the question comes up is, the next security issue would be, what's to stop me from setting up 30 computers with sock puppet accounts so that when Bob goes out and sends it out to the network, all of my computers are saying, yes, it's real, regardless of whether it is. So we need to have something in place that will prevent me from setting up all these accounts to just quickly verify it. We call that the proof of work. Now, all the transactions that come in will have to go through a computation, something complex, something that's going to take up a lot of computing power and electricity, so that it's not worth it for me to set up 30 computers and fake that. And it has to be something that's secure. So the difficulty, something that's difficult to compute, difficult to solve, but easy to confirm. Think of a really difficult Sudoku puzzle. It might take you hours to complete it. But once you do, and you give it to somebody else to look at, they can look at it, go, you know, no duplicates here, no duplicates here, no duplicates here. Yes, it's solved. So it's difficult to complete, but easy to confirm. So that proof of work, done with a hash. It's the hashing the encryption. So I send a coin to Bob. Charlie sends a coin to David. Eleanor sends one to Fran. And all the nodes will verify all these validity of all these transactions. And they will be running these transactions through a cryptography protocol called SHA-256. Currently, that is the most extensive cryptographical protocol there is. It is today unbreakable. It's not to say that in the future, when computers become more and more powerful, as we know with Moore's Law, where computers just keep getting more powerful, yes, one day it might be broken. And at that point, the protocol will be changed, because this is open source, to use the next highest protocol that can't be broken with those computers. But for now, SHA-256 is unbreakable as you're going to get. It's what the military uses. And then what they're doing is they're doing a mathematical computation using all the transactions that were done, running it through this protocol, adding a nonce, which is another number to that, and doing it in sequence until they come up with a solution. The solution is generally going to be a certain number that's below a certain threshold. The answer starts with four zeros, would be for starters. And as it gets more and more difficult, as the more and more computers working on these, as the network grows, they have to increase the difficulty. So we increase the difficulty so that it takes about the same amount of time to compute a block. And again, so now we might have the answer. To confirm a solved block, would have to have 6 zeros. As it gets more difficult, it might have 10 zeros. So a really small number, it takes longer to compute. That is the proof of work. And what happens is, and this is an example like of a mining rig, this is the kind of computing software we need today. Because there are so many people doing this, and the difficulty level has gone so high that you can no longer do it with your laptop computer. You need a rig like this if you're going to be doing this mining for yourself. And the purpose of doing all this, the reward for coming up with that solution and solving that block, because once it's solved, you confirm the transactions, and those transactions now get added to the blockchain, and as a reward, you get 25 bitcoins. Every 10 minutes, 25 bitcoins are generated. And that's what the difficulty is for. Every 2 weeks, the computing power, that's the number of hashes that are done per second, is evaluated by the protocol and automatically adjusted, the difficulty level, so that it will average out to one block solved every 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes, 25 new bitcoins are generated. It started out as 50, and every 4 years, it's halved. So now it's been 4 years, they're down to 25 bitcoins. In 4 more years, the reward for solving a block will be 12.5 bitcoins. And this will continue until the year 2140. That's when the last bitcoin will be mined, and there will be 21 million bitcoins. At that point, the miners will get the reward that they get will be the transaction fees. Transaction fees are minute because there's no middleman. If you take a transaction through a credit card, you have to pay at the minimum 3-4%. If you're a big business, maybe a little bit less. If you're doing a transaction with Square, it might be a little bit more. But if you're still paying that large percentage, whereas with Bitcoin, the transaction fee could be 3 cents. Right now, that's not much because there's not that many transactions going through. By the time of the year 2140, if this takes off like it's supposed to, like it most likely will, then there will be a lot of transactions being taking place. So the reward will be the transaction fees for solving a block. So to recap on this, we have a limited supply. The blocks are generated once every 10 minutes. 50 coins halving every 4 years until there are 21 million blocks, and then that will be the final block generated in the year 2140. So that is the backbone for bitcoins. That front coin that we generated, all those protocols that we needed to keep it secure are the backbone of the Bitcoin network. Not everybody has to be mining for bitcoins. You can still be on the network with just a wallet. And that is the basic piece of equipment that you need, or the software that you need in order to transact with bitcoins. You need some place to store it. We call that a wallet. And that's a program that runs on your computer. They have them for the cell phones too. You can run it on your, well, not Apple, because Apple took them off the market, but you can still do it on an Android phone. And Apple will have to cave eventually as bitcoins become more and more popular. But you can store them on a wallet. And so this is an example of a Windows. You have an address here. That's where you send, that is a 32-digit payment address. You'll never see a duplicate address because it's based on that's your public key. It's based from your private key. And the random combination, there could be 2 to the power of 127 different combinations of that number. So you'll never get a duplicate. You can create as many wallets as you want. You put in the amount that you're sending it to, and you hit send. Boom, that goes out onto the network and goes through all those computers. It goes through every node on the network. All the people that are mining are computing and running those hashes. One of them will solve it within 10 minutes, and it gets added to the blockchain. That transaction is complete and confirmed. And it keeps on getting confirmed as more and more computers become aware of it. So you see it'll be 2 confirmations, 3 confirmations. By the time you hit 6 confirmations, there is no possibility that transaction did not go through. Right. So it started out at a rate of 50 every 10 minutes for the first year. There's one block solved every 10 minutes. For the first 4 years, it was 50. And each 4 years, that is divided in half. That gets added to the chain. So every 10 minutes, another 25, and it keeps adding. So we won't hit 21 million until the year 2140 based on that 10-minute average. And then there will never be another one minted. So that's the limited supply. Unlike fiat currency, where you can, the government can go and print as much as they want, there will never be another Bitcoin printed. A lot of people look at Bitcoins to be like the original gold that our representative currency was based on. There's a limited supply of gold. And just like gold, you can't destroy it. You could lose it. If you're on a ship and you throw it overboard, it's gone forever. Same thing goes with Bitcoins. If you have that on your wallet and your hard drive crashes, those coins are lost forever. So it's very important to back it up. Yes, but eventually there's a limited supply of gold in the world. At one point, and it might be 1,000 years from now, there'll be no more gold. There's only a finite amount of gold. And it's like the California gold rush. Originally, they had a lot. That's what caused the gold rush. People found a lot of gold. And everybody came out and mined it. Now it's very difficult to find gold. But yes, it is still being mined, but eventually we're going to run out. And Bitcoins were made with that in mind, that it will eventually run out. The only difference is we know exactly when. So this Bitcoin, that's the main currency. That's the first one. That's the granddaddy of cryptocurrency. If anything has a chance of becoming a de facto standard of currency, it will be the Bitcoin. But that protocol has been copied by many what we call alt currencies. So it's not only Bitcoin, but there's other coins out there that have different purposes. It might be, instead of using it for currency, there's a lot of people that are wondering what they could use it for. Right now it's investments. People are trading them, buying and selling these coins, but nobody's really accepting these other coins, such as Litecoin. Litecoin is another coin that uses a different protocol. It doesn't use the SHA-256. It uses something called Scrypt. It's a lot easier to mine. The difficulty is a lot lighter. You can still mine them on a CPU. Very slowly, but you can still use a regular computer to mine them, or a graphics processor. You can use your GPU to mine the Litecoin. There's Namecoin. There's Dogecoin. Dogecoin blows my mind because this was something that was created out of a meme. So we know lolcats, right? That ICANN has cheeseburger. So the Doge is the dog equivalent of the lolcat. It's with the funny dog speak. They don't call it mining. They call it digging for coins. Created almost as a joke. And it quickly became the third most traded coin. It blows my mind how popular that became. There's TerraCoin, FeatherCoin, there's PeerCoin, there's FryCoin, there's tons and tons and tons of coins. And it just blows my mind how many coins there are. There's probably about 30 or 40 coins out there that are being minted. Now, they can have different purposes. This is why I mentioned Scrypt. Because I look at the altcoins as being like Scrypt, being to Bitcoins what Scrypt is to legal tender. They may have different purposes, such as within a specific community. Maybe we know like games like online games, like World of Warcraft, they have their own economy, which is not based on coins, it's just based on they generate, you do things in the game, you fight monsters in the game, and you get a reward for it, and you get gold or whatever the value is in the game. And people actually trade this because they're into the game, and they trade this for money. They'll buy with U.S. money, with their own money, they will buy in-game money. Well, a great way to secure that so that it doesn't change the markets in there is to make, let's say, a WoW coin. Why not make a WoW coin for World of Warcraft so that you're mining it just the way you would do with the other altcoins, and you use them in the game? Different coins can have different purposes. There's even talk about using the cryptography behind the coins for purposes of voting. Some companies may use those coins that they generate for stock. Instead of having stock certificates, they'll issue coins in their company that could be traded for other coins or other currencies. Well, that's where the next part of my presentation comes in, because something interesting just happened recently. Patrick Byrne, CEO of Overstock.com, was the first, and this is only a few weeks ago, was the first online retailer to accept Bitcoins for anything that they sell on Overstock.com. And in the first day, they had 600 new customers just in the first day, and I believe it was something like $30,000 just in the first day of sales through Bitcoins. And they're constantly getting more and more customers who are really appreciative of the fact that now they can actually use them. So much so that within a week, Tiger Direct followed them. There are more places. And when Overstock does this, and they're taking up market share, you can bet that Amazon.com has to follow soon. And if they don't, they're going to lose market share. And when Amazon takes Bitcoins, that's when this will really take off. Sacramento Kings is the first pro sports team to accept Bitcoins for payment for tickets. Zynga now takes Bitcoins. So you can now use your Bitcoins to buy sheep for your Farmville. Virgin Galactic, you could use Bitcoins to secure your seat on the next space flight. WordPress is taking Bitcoins. Reddit, Tiger Direct joined the game. So there's more and more places that are accepting Bitcoins for currency, for purchases of goods and services. The list is going to continue to grow. There was a subway, it was only one subway, but it was an experiment in Pennsylvania where they were accepting Bitcoins. So your $5 footlong became a 0.06 Bitcoin footlong. And they said that he was getting about 3 customers per day that were paying in Bitcoin. Not a lot, but it's one single store, and it's an experiment. So it's really in a speculative stage right now. That's why the price is volatile, because it's very speculative. We don't know where it's going to go. But the trend right now is that as more and more places are accepting it, the more it's going to be used, the more it's going to become more common. I don't think it's ever going to replace fiat currency. Not everybody is going to accept this. Not everybody is going to be embracing this. At least not in our lifetimes. Maybe our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren, remember this goes through, they're planning this to go well past 2140, will be all digital. But over the next couple of generations, not everybody's going to give up paper currency. However, if you think about when paper currency first was started to use, what value did that have? People were wondering, what am I going to do? Pieces of paper? I'm going to use that to buy goods and services? Paper? With things printed on it? The original people, when they first made paper currency, probably were facing the same thing. No, I want to use my gold. I want to use these precious metals and stuff. I want to use gems. That's what has value. What are these pieces of paper that represent gems? But it caught on. So there is the great possibility of this catching on and really doing well and becoming a complementary currency, one that we don't have to worry about foreign exchange, because the Bitcoin is the same in the United States as it is in China, which, although they have made it illegal to exchange it for currency, you can still use it to spend. It's the same Bitcoin in Japan. It's the same Bitcoin in Europe. No matter where you are in the world, where else can you go and send somebody? If you wanted to send somebody $5,000, you can do it in an instant. You don't have to wait for the bank to open. You don't have to pay a middleman a fee. You just send them the Bitcoin, and within seconds, they receive it. And within 10 minutes, it's confirmed. And there's no backsies. Once it's sent, it's sent. There's no way that somebody can do a reverse transaction. Credit card, you can go and do a chargeback. You can't do that with Bitcoin. Once it's sent, it's sent. So you have that security when you receive it of knowing that you have it. Almost like cash. When you go to a bank, you want to open up a bank account. You have to give them your all of your identity, your social security number. You have to give them all this information in order to get an account and an account number to do transactions and then to pay them for the privilege of doing that. With Bitcoins, it's almost anonymous. I say almost anonymous because everything is in the blockchain. If somebody wanted to investigate and do all the groundwork to find out where that transaction came from, they could trace it back eventually. It can be traced. But it is virtually anonymous. Because all you have to do is install the software on your computer, and boom, you have an account number. That 32-digit number that's generated, that's your account number. Somebody could send it to you. So if I went to, on this computer right here, if I were to go and download the Bitcoin software, install it, you can immediately send money to that address. And they can start collecting it. No identity needed. You don't have to give up your social security number. You don't have to give up your name, your address. None of that. So it is virtually anonymous. Ah, security. We need security. That's the next topic. Thank you for that segue, though. Oh, he's asking, if you have it on his cell phone, and you can put a wallet on your cell phone. If somebody stole your cell phone, what would happen to the money? Well, you need to have some sort of security. All it is a wallet. There is no, you can encrypt your wallet with a password. Now, that will prevent somebody else, if somebody found your phone, from going in and spending the money because it's encrypted with your password. They don't know your password, they can't access your money. However, if you lose your password, if you can't remember your password, on a website, you can go to the website, click forgot password, and they will email you a link to create a new password. With the wallet, there's no such thing. You forget your password, that wallet is history. And every penny in there is gone. Well, they can't hack into the wallet unless they have your wallet. Because remember, it's still protected by the cryptography. It's still protected by your private key. All they will know is your public key. But they don't have your private key. So that is what's stored on your computer. That's what the program is generating, is your private key. You can encrypt that private key so that if somebody, and that's another, so there's different levels of security. For one is, you want to have a password protected, so if somebody got into your computer and they got a hold of your wallet or they got a hold of your cell phone, they can't spend it. So you want to have at least a password to protect it. But there's also, you also want to have some other kind of backups. For instance, you can have a paper backup. There's a software called Armory. That's a wallet software that will allow you to do a paper backup. It will print on a piece of paper two lines of code. You could take that and put it in your safe deposit box. And if you forgot your password, if you lost your computer, if your hard drive crashed and you could not recover the data off of your hard drive, this is why you want backups, and you couldn't recover the data off your hard drive, all you need is you go to your safe deposit box, you take out that piece of paper, you load up the software, and you type in those two lines of code, and you have your wallet back. So that's cold storage, offline storage, something that's not attached to the internet, something that people can't get into your system and hack. Because we all know about spyware and malware. If you go to a website to download something and you get hijacked to the wrong website that looks like the right website, and you download the software and now there's a virus on your system, they're looking for that wallet.dat file so they can get a copy of it and open it up and start spending all your bitcoins. You want that protected with a password. Yes, that's all done on your software. That, as long as you have that, you can still have access to your wallet. As long as you have access to your wallet, you can change anything in there. You can change it, you can remove the encryption. But you have to have the password in order to do that. And even if you couldn't do that, all you would have to do, as long as you have access to your wallet, all you have to do is open up another wallet. Or create another wallet and send your money to that wallet. As a matter of fact, because of the fact that people can trace, like once you make a transaction, it's in the blockchain, and there's websites where you can view the blockchain in its entirety. You can look at any block, and there are some people who just have that time to do that, can actually look at yours, and then once they know your public key, and they see a transaction, they can see every transaction you made with that wallet. Create another wallet on the same program, can create another wallet, or on your phone, or on a different computer, or even on the same computer with a different wallet program that's going to create a whole different private key. You can transfer from one wallet to the other. Just like I would send you a Bitcoin, you can send a Bitcoin to yourself. So if you were worried about a wallet, and let's say there was a situation where you absolutely could not change it. You had a wallet that would not let you change the password. Well, just send it to another wallet. Well, it's not centralized. It's decentralized. It's stored on everybody's computer. When you download a wallet, there's two types of wallets. The main wallet, like if you download the Bitcoin QT, which is the one that's on the Bitcoin.org website, when you download that wallet, you're not going to be able to use it for probably several hours. Because what happens is when you first install it, it's downloading the entire blockchain, every transaction that's taken place since 2010. And that blockchain is stored on your computer, as well as stored on your computer, and on your computer, and all the people that are mining. The people who are mining are using that same software. They're just doing, there's another program that they're running that works with that software to do the mining. But using it as a wallet, you still have the entire blockchain. There are other wallets that are called light wallets, kind of like a thin, the equivalent of like a thin client, where it does not have to download the entire blockchain. And it works off of just the recent transactions of the blockchain. But the full blockchain, if you have a full wallet, will download the entire blockchain. You're going to need computers that size to start. It's going to be mostly the miners. At that point, it's probably going to be most of the people that are using it are going to be using light clients that don't have to store the entire blockchain, whereas the majority of the nodes will be, who are especially the miners, will be using the entire blockchain. And it's going to get very, very long. Most of it is not accessed. It's only the recent ones that are really accessed, but it can be, they can verify transactions. Like, for instance, that very first person, the very first Bitcoin that were ever generated, if they weren't spent, and 500 years from now, 50 years from now, say, somebody goes to, opens up that wallet and those coins are still there and goes to spend them, they have to be verified from the beginning of the blockchain. So those would be the miners that would have that, but that's going to eventually grow. And it's an open protocol, so there might be changes that will happen, because there's always updates. Like, for instance, if a situation like that occurred, there's things that would be done to update it. So if something were to break encryption, if something were to become too much that computers can handle, these are things that have to be addressed, but they're always addressed, and the source is open source, so it's always updated. So it always can be updated. And updates are protected as well, because updates will not be accepted unless more than 51% of the network. It has to be more than 51% of the network has to agree. Which opens up on some of the smaller coins, like the alt currencies that don't have as many users on the nodes as Bitcoins, there can be what they call a 51% attack, where a group or an organization can set up 51% of the power, of the computing power, and they can control the coin. Bitcoin, especially when that blockchain gets so huge and the more people are using it, that's one of the security features, is that nobody can make such an attack, because nobody will have that much control. The bigger it gets, the more secure it is. Well, it's when it's not a matter of voting, it's a matter of when there's updates. You know, if there was, let's say there was a security breach, something happened, somebody broke the SHA-256, and there was a security breach. Anything that could happen would be detected within the one block. It would only affect one block, because by then it would be discovered and changes would be made and no other transactions would be able to go through until the computers were updated. So they would almost be forced to do that because of that. So if somebody, for instance, there could be situations where there's duplicates. Like, for instance, two computers on one node here in the United States and one node in Japan both solved a block at about the same time, because it's random. A block could be solved in 10 minutes, a block could be solved in 30 seconds. It depends on your luck. So if a block was solved really quickly, or two blocks were solved close to each other, they both get broadcast. Once a block is solved, it's sent out to the entire node, and each node, as it gets it, will add it to the blockchain. But what happens is the only blockchains that are accepted are the ones that are the longest. So if it was a close call, one of those blocks that was solved may not actually go through, may not be accepted. Mining, as a matter of fact, most people who mine don't mine solo anymore because of the amount of power that's required, and they mine in pools. So you have these mining pools where it's a bunch of us, let's say 50, 100 people, all using their computer power to work towards solving the next block. And when it's solved, it gets shared between them. Because there's not enough computing power. There's too many people out there. There's too many nodes. There's not enough computing power to do that, to take over 51%. Like, even if you have the largest pool, let's say there was somebody who had to go, let's say a group would come along to try to take over. So let's say that you have honest people, and you have people who want to try to find a way to hack the system, and the greedy people. Now, those greedy people have to all be in the same pool. They would have to all be doing it at the same time together. Because if you have group A of greedy people, let's even say 20% of greedy people in group A, 20% in group B, and 20% in group C is 60%, but the other 40% of the people who are honest are the majority. Beats each 20%, because each group, so if an entire pool was filled with people trying to hack the system, trying to find loopholes, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be accepted by the others, because the majority would be honest. What was it about? What was the story? Well, there's a lot of interesting things happening, and a lot of scandals as we're hearing about, like, for instance, with Silk Road, which was a place where people were paying bitcoins for drugs and other illegal activities. There was the situation of the exchanges that were doing money laundering, and even Mt. Gox, which is one of the exchanges where you could trade your bitcoins for cash, for cryptocurrency, has been having a lot of scandals going on with that, where they were holding on to issues with the banks. There's going to be a lot of that out there in any system, and especially in any open system. There's going to be a lot of things that are people that are going to try to game the system. There are going to be people who are trying to do things illegally. If you think back to the early 90s, when the internet was in its infancy as far as being a common thing. Of course, you know, the internet started back in 1969, but in the 90s, when the internet started becoming popular amongst the common people, not just military and universities, but everybody was starting to get online, so many places it was about illegal activities, pornography, child porn, all these things that were going on. It was like, oh my God, you're going to give people free access to do whatever they want and post anything they want. How could that possibly catch on? How could that possibly work? And look where we are now with the internet. Sure, there's still things going on, but it's nearly as much. These things weed themselves out. We have regulations, things that come into place, and changes take place. There have been a lot of changes in protocols on the internet since the 90s. There's going to be a lot of changes of things that we can't even foresee right now in the future with bitcoins and any other type of digital currency. No, there's exchanges online. For example, there's Coinbase.com is one of the more popular ones. Like, for instance, a lot of people originally were using that Mt. Gox. They were the giants. They were the ones in the early days where you would go, you send them bitcoins, and you can change it for cash, and they wire it to your bank account. And they're located in Japan, and they had a lot of trouble sending them out. Recently, a lot of people have been stopping to using them and using this Coinbase, which is another exchange where you have your bitcoins, and you trade them for the current trading value, and they deposit the cash equivalent into your account. It depends on whatever it is you trade it for. You could trade them for dollars, you could trade them for euros, you can trade them for yen, you could trade for any other currency. Here, we would trade them for dollars. The idea about, and we think about it like this, so when you think about transactions, I want to buy something and it's $100 and I have to go in my head and calculate, okay, that's like 0.14 bitcoins, okay, and I send 0.14 bitcoins. I have to do a translation to dollars because our economy currently is based on dollars. Similarly, if I were to travel to Thailand and I were visiting and I go into a store and something costs 300 baht, I'm going to be sitting there, 300 baht, okay, exchange rate is, okay, so that's $10. Okay, I'll buy that. Here's 300 baht, thinking in my mind, $10. But if I were to move to Thailand, and I lived in Thailand and worked there, and I go into a store to buy something for 300 baht, I'm not even thinking of dollars, I'm just saying, okay, there's 300 baht. So, once it becomes more common, it's something that we will be just using. We won't even have to think about it. It's going to, if it becomes more common, we don't have to do those translations. Right now, the CEO of Overstock, I was listening to an interview he had this morning, and he said that exactly what he's doing is that as soon as they come in, they are cashing them out because he does have to pay his suppliers, and his suppliers aren't accepting bitcoins yet. He's gambling on the fact that eventually it will take off, and that he will be able to pay, if not all, some of his employees. If some of his employees start to say, hey, you know what, I like this trend you're going on, you can pay me in bitcoins. Then he'll start cashing out less and less, and as more and more places, if Amazon were to start accepting bitcoins, they would probably have enough buying power to be able to have the suppliers start accepting bitcoins for their goods. Yes, and eventually it will stable out, just like anything else is volatile. Right now it's very volatile because of everything that's going on between the things that are going on with the scandals with the Russian government and the Chinese government. Yeah, it will be volatility, but eventually it will, when it stables out, when it stabilizes, we will see things more accepted. I believe that it's time to take a break right now, and I will now, like, thank you. We'll come back a little bit later for some more questions and answers. Well, actually, one thing I want to say is, from some of the discussions we were having during the break, I think that the Patrick Byrne from Overstock, I think he was brilliant in what he's done. By accepting bitcoins, even if he is just converting them immediately to dollars, but by offering to accept bitcoins from currency, what he's doing is he's giving people another way to pay. So it's not changing the core of his business, but it's offering people another way to pay
and get more business, and of course breaking ground by being the first to do that. It's brilliant. Now that more people, and so that other companies can see, if they see this possibility, they don't have to change their core business. All they have to do is add one more method of payment. They already accept MasterCard, Visa. We saw a lot of companies when PayPal started growing that they accept PayPal now as well as MasterCard and Visa. And now more companies start saying, okay, we accept MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, and Bitcoins. The more companies that do this, it's just another way to pay. And the more companies that do that, the more it will grow and become less volatile. That's how I think about that. It really was a genius move to do this and to set that trend. Oh, yes. Yes, and if you look at Star Trek, for one thing, Star Trek has been a show from the 60s, has inspired a lot of the technology that we see today. Cell phones, communicators, tablets. You look at every time they say, Captain, here's our report. It's basically an iPad he's giving him, well before the iPad was ever invented. And when you look in the future, they don't use currency there. Everything they do, they buy it is in credits. That'll be 50 credits. That'll be 100 credits. Credits might be those bitcoins of the future that they're talking about. That is, we're looking at a few. They see the future as not having currency, having one universal currency, or that they call credits. They use the word credits because it's not currency. So bitcoins not being legal tender, I think there's a good analogy there. Well, the people that are monitoring it are the people that are mining, the people that have wallets. If something were to go wrong, if something were to happen, it would probably not affect more than one block. Remember that those blocks are solved once every 10 minutes. So if something happened, or somebody did a duplicate transaction, or found a hole in the system, or something went wrong, it would be caught right away. People would say, hey, what's going on here? And it might halt the system, and they may have to put out a new fix, an update, find some way to patch that, but it wouldn't affect more than one block of data. I don't think that I think the only thing that can take down Bitcoin is Bitcoin itself if something blew up in the software, in the algorithm, in the routine. But I don't think people are going to, but there are possibilities. Everything is software. But the fact that it's open source and everybody has access to it, people can make suggestions, say, hey, this looks like a security hole and it can be researched. Well, when I say there's 21 million Bitcoins, this is another thing that came up during the break. It's actually, it goes down divided. The smallest unit of Bitcoin currency, like with the dollar, the smallest unit of currency is a penny. Unless you're a gas station, they somehow like to go things in 0.9 cents. But other than that, the smallest regular U.S. currency is a penny. Now with Bitcoin, the Bitcoin actually goes down to 8 decimal places. So the smallest unit of Bitcoin currency is 0.00000001 Bitcoin. They actually call that a Satoshi, named after Satoshi Nakamoto. So the Satoshi is, so if you take that 21 million, if you multiply it by 10 million, add that many decimal places, I'm doing the math up here real quick, but there's a lot more of units of currency that are available. And what the value is, it may seem so now, but you're not going to go around, they actually call them like micro coins. That's like an N, like instead of the B, the symbol that I had up there, the B with the dollars, with the slashes through it is the Bitcoin. Like, so they have like a lowercase m. MB is a micro Bitcoin. UV is a pico Bitcoin. So rather than having to say 0.001, depending on where the currency goes and how, what value it has as far as, and I don't mean value is in comparing it to a dollar, but the value as in purchasing a loaf of bread, might be talking not in bitcoins but in micro bitcoins, or it might be in pico bitcoins that we vision the currency when we're paying for things. Well, the mining is really what makes it grow. That's what's funding it. That's what's making it so that it's putting bitcoins out there. But you don't have the thing about the mining is if the right now the hardware to do it is expensive, so it's cost prohibitive to jump in and start mining. You have the equipment is very expensive. It uses a lot of electricity. So there's questions of how much money you really make from mining. The idea is not that it's something to do for profit so much as it is to secure the network, and the bitcoins are the reward for using your computing power to do so. So it's not about the mining. It's about getting the coins generated, securing the network, but it's more about using them as a currency and spending them. So it's not so much the miners, it's about having a wallet software so that you can have access to, which is like I said, your bank account, so you have access to spend them.
These yes. other cryptocurrencies, now I suspect that the inventors of them had some quibble with bitcoins and said, I can do better. What are the comparisons?
Okay, this is some of the coins are like Litecoin, for instance. That came out because it was easier to mine. Because when, as I said, the difficulty keeps adjusting, so that average of that 10-minute average stays in place. So it became so difficult that you couldn't even use your graphics processor. It started off with your CPU, and as more people started doing it, and people realized, hey, I can use the power of my graphics processor, which is a lot faster. And more people started doing that. The difficulty went up from there, and then. As it exploded and people started going to the next level of equipment, which is, they call the ASIC miners. These are chips that have one function. It takes that hash and it comes out with an answer. That's all that chip does, and it does them in gigahashes. So you see, you know, instead of, if the CPU could do in thousands of hashes, kilohashes, then these graphics processors were doing mega hashes. These units are doing gigahashes. It gets more and more difficult. And yeah, so, right, and getting into, there's other purposes that some coins have a specific purpose, other coins have different features. One of the coins is called Frycoin, which is relatively easier to mine. It uses a lighter protocol with a lower difficulty, but those coins don't stay in your wallet. Those are designed not to hold onto, but to spend, and if you don't spend them, they degrade. That's a feature of that coin, whether what purpose that has and where that falls into place. I wouldn't even know where to begin with that. And all the other coins, they could have specific purposes within, like I said, using the analogy of the script. It may have their own place within a smaller economy. So, or within a company, for instance, a company can create, for example, coins that they generate in the same way and use them as a way to give bonuses to employees. Now, it doesn't cost them any money to create them, but they will eventually have a value not as a currency to go and spend, but as an investment. The way a lot of people are looking at bitcoins now, people are investing in them, which is what brought up the value. Each of the coins has some specific value, and they are trading. So you can go and sell, you can trade Litecoins for bitcoins, Litecoins for dollars. You can send Feather coin is another coin. You can sell the Dogecoin. These are all being traded. So each coin has some specific value. I don't see any of the alt currencies as becoming a regular currency that people will spend. I can't see any online merchants or any merchant stores or restaurants accepting Dogecoin. But I can see them accepting Bitcoins. That's the giant. That's the one that started with the purpose of becoming a currency. So each coin could have its, and TerraCoin, these are all, all these coins have, like they have a goal. Some of the coins, actually, one of the things that people look at with the coins, with the altcoins, is, again, it's all open source. You can see the code. Some is, they frown against pre-mining. So some coins might start with, they have a network of computers set up within a building, within their company, that are mining within each other until they have 5 million coins, and they say, hey, welcome, look at this new coin that's out there. And now they have 5 million of them, and they're saying, okay, alright, now people go out and mine them. That's called pre-mining. And people won't, those coins will never really grow in value because people will say, hey, wait a minute. You've already started them with 5 million because we can see the blockchain.
Have you any knowledge of the Townsend plan or $30 every Thursday or ham and eggs?
No green eggs and ham. No, I don't know those. Well, you mean like the IRS wanting their share of the taxes?
Yes.
Like I said, it's not anonymous. It's pseudo-anonymous, but it is not anonymous. And I'm sure at some point, if that becomes the case, they will have some kind of... The government can't control bitcoins as far as like they can with money as far as the supply of the money. But they can control laws. So they can control laws on the exchanges. So if you're going to be converting them to dollars, that's one place where they can find it. And they can monitor the network. The NSA is probably... I'm sure the NSA is a big miner. So of all the mining that's going on out there, I'm sure the NSA is a big part of that and watching over. So I'm sure that they will find their way. Actually, I guarantee they will find their way to get their share of it.
Well, okay, we'll let's not get too far in this. We need 10 minutes for the raffle, even though there isn't too much stuff up here. So let's finish with one or two more questions. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, there was something I heard an interview recently. I think it was on there's a podcast called Let's Talk Bitcoins. If you look for it on the Apple, iTunes, they broadcast on there. I think it was last week, and they had an interview. I can't remember his name, but it was a thing called Colony Earth. And it was a community where they were talking about using their own coin, their own cryptocurrency, as a currency within the community. And also, people would live there, and they would get paid in for the time they would have, like, for instance, their rent would be either the cryptocurrency, it would be a self-sustaining permaculture, where they would live off land, they would be off the grid, have their own electricity, farm their own food, and they would pay their rent either in time by working, or in the crypto, or in their own currency. So that might be something about what you're talking about. But I would look into that. It's called Colony Earth. That might be along the lines of what you're. I wouldn't know, but I know that this one they're talking about doing this in other nations. But I know that they do have a colony that they are working, that they do have right now, which is in, I think it's South Carolina, somewhere on the East Coast. I think it's South Carolina. So it is something that is operating in the U.S. I don't know how the tax portion of that would go, though. And then everybody goes, no, I don't. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.